Few things in life are as heartbreaking as a disability, especially one from birth. Disabilities break into life in various forms and at various stages. Sometimes they're a product of genetic misalignments in the womb. Sometimes they're the results of tragic accidents, or the byproducts of infectious diseases or medical events such as strokes, or from the degenerative effects of old age. They affect joints, bones, nervous system, lungs, hearts, brains. Even in the United States, the country that leads the world in medical technology and innovation, roughly 20% of our citizens live with a physical disability. Blindness is one of those disabilities that affects many. A number of years ago, it was reported that in the United States, somebody goes blind every 20 minutes. I haven't been able to discover any more current information than that. But through various agencies, and I know they have different standards as to what constitutes blindness, all agree that it continues to be a problem, even in modern times. Now, back in Jesus' day, blindness was also common. It was sometimes a result of a birth defect or infection. It could be leprosy, which was much more common in those days than it is in our culture. Cataracts or advanced age. But the prospects for blind people in those days was certainly not as promising as today. Most of them were relegated to beg for money just to survive. And we're introduced to such an individual in the 9th chapter of the Gospel of John. This account is set sometime between the Feast of Tabernacles, and that happened in the September-October time of year, and before the Feast of Dedication, which we know today as Hanukkah, which is in late December. This happened somewhere in the vicinity of Jerusalem, but outside the temple complex. John 8 records some events that happened at the Feast of Tabernacles that year. Some believe that chapter 9 follows immediately after that. However, some think that it ties more in with chapter 10, which takes place around Hanukkah. But in either case, we're looking at between 6 and 8 months before Jesus' death the following spring. Events are beginning to lead up toward those critical moments that would lead to his crucifixion. Tensions had been mounting for some time between Jesus and the Jewish leadership in Jerusalem, and this event we're going to look at today only heightened those tensions. Now we begin in chapter 9, verse 1. As Jesus went along, he saw a man blind from birth. And what we find is that the interactions between Jesus, his disciples, Jesus and this blind man, the blind man and others, take up the entire 9th chapter of John. We see in these verses the attitudes and the actions of various people grappling with this situation. But then I'd like to conclude this morning with some applications for ourselves in this whole area of dealing with disabilities. Let's first consider the attitudes toward the disabled. The first we encounter is that of the disciples. In verse 2, they ask Jesus, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" They display the attitude of calloused curiosity. You see, the disciples did not look at the man as an object of mercy, but rather as a subject for a theological discussion. They wanted to debate the subject because it's much easier to discuss an abstract subject like sin than it is to minister to the concrete need of a life or of a person. For them, the blind man was a riddle to be solved rather than a sufferer to be relieved. You know, it's easy to become calloused when dealing with people in need. How many of us have seen the folks outside Walmart and outside various places with a little sign that says that they're homeless, they're hungry, looking for work, looking for food? The more you see it, the easier it is to pass by. And the disciples, I'm sure, were used to seeing the blind and the crippled and those who had nothing more they could do than to simply beg for the mercy of others in order to survive. And as they see this man, and I don't know if they knew of his story or if somebody else had explained it. Don't know how they knew he had been blind from birth. But they see him, and their attitude is kind of like, oh, here's case number 321. Here's another one, Jesus. And you see enough of them along the road begging, your heart can easily become indifferent to beggars. By and by, we begin to see all beggars alike. And so the blind man becomes a topic of a theological discussion. Some of you have heard me share this before, but this actually happened when I was in seminary studying for my master's degree. I was in a class that was a class on pastoral counseling. And there were other ministers that were taking this course at the same time. And I had gotten there early. I had gotten my place up in the front. I like to sit up in the front while I was in school. Less distractions, I guess. And one of my fellow students came up to the professor before class began. And he said, I've got a situation in my church, and I'd like your advice. He said that there was a couple that lived immediately across the street from their church building. They were living together, but they were not married. One Sunday evening, as church was letting out, a fire broke out in that house. And the fire department was called, and they did what they could, but it was a total loss. The couple got out themselves, but everything inside was destroyed. And immediately the church stepped in, and they offered blankets and clothes and food, and they really reached out to this couple, and they made an impact. The couple was impressed that these church folks that they didn't know and it didn't know them would reach out to them in their time of need. So they began to attend the church. And in time, they became convicted of their living situation. They were living together and not being married. So they approached the minister and said, we would like to get married. We feel that's the right thing to do. And since you folks have been so good to us, we would really like to have the service here at your church, and we would like you to perform it. But that minister in that church had a policy against performing marriages for couples who were living together. So he didn't know what to do. And he asked the professor for his advice. And the professor said to him, you should never have helped them in the first place. And my reaction was much like what yours was just now. My jaw just, bam, hit the table. I thought, you got to be kidding me. And he went on to say that he believed that the fire that had destroyed the contents of the home was God's judgment on their living in sin, and that by reaching out to them in grace actually hindered the work of God in their lives. And I came so close to getting up and walking out of that classroom and never going back. But I didn't. I stayed with it and finished my studies. But I could not believe what I had just heard. That we would put a theological debate over the welfare of individuals. But that's exactly what the disciples did here. Not one time do you see any of the 12 say, wow, Jesus, do you think you could help this man? I know you've done some great miracles. This guy was born blind. Does he have any hope? Is there something you can do? I don't see any of them turning to Judas and saying, hey, we've got some extra money in the bag. Why don't you throw some in? no concern whatsoever for the individual. They wanted to debate a theological issue. Never mind that the man is a beggar in need of help. Never mind that he has spent his entire life literally in darkness. Never mind that the man is seated in front of them, and while he is blind, he's not deaf. You ever thought of that? How would you like to be the blind person that you can hear the guy saying, "Oh, by the way, who do you think sinned? He or his parents?" I'm sure they didn't take Jesus off to the side and whisper it. In fact, what do most of us do when we're confronted with somebody that has a vision impairment? We tend to talk louder, don't we? We tend to think if we talk louder, they'll be able to hear us. And I know many of them must think, "I'm not deaf. It's my eyes, not my ears." In fact, if anything, the ears hear more when they're not able to see with their eyes. They wanted to talk about his sin. And we wonder, how could they be so harsh? How could they be so insensitive? And the answer, though we may not like it, is that it is easier to label a person than it is to help a person. It is easier to debate homosexuality or gay marriage than it is to befriend a gay person. It's easier to discuss divorce than it is to help those who have been divorced. It's easier to argue abortion than to support an orphanage. It's easier to complain about the welfare system than it is to help the poor. In short, it's easier to label than it is to love. And that's the attitude we see manifested by the disciples. The label they put on him was sinner. See, in those days it was widely held that suffering, especially something as severe as blindness, was due to sin. There was a rabbi back then who was famous for this saying, "There is no death without sin, and there is no suffering without iniquity." Now, theologically, that's correct. We know that sin introduced disability, disaster, disease, and ultimately death. We understand that. But they took it a step further, and they all thought they were Sherlock Holmes trying to figure out what specific sin caused this specific suffering. And it became somewhat of a game, trying to figure out who's to blame. Who's to blame for this situation? Why did this happen? Now, we might think that the question is ridiculous. They said, "Who sinned, this man's parents or he himself, that he was born blind?" Think about that. I remember there was a fellow at my home church when I was growing up, and he used to go around and say, "Yeah, I helped my dad build the log cabin I was born in." Think about that for a minute. That makes no sense whatsoever. And that question almost fits into that category, doesn't it? How could this guy sin before he was born to deserve this blindness? But in those days, there were rabbis who taught that a child could sin in the womb. They took a verse out of Psalm 58:3, "The wicked go astray from the womb." They applied that to Jacob and Esau, because remember, they were twins, and they were kind of jostling around in their mother's womb. And they tried to prove that Esau sinned before he was born. There's nothing in Scripture to support that. But again, this is part of the theological debate that the rabbis loved to get into. So it was possible, at least for the disciples, that this man could have sinned before his birth and that he deserved to be blind. Or perhaps his parents were to blame. Maybe they were guilty of some horrible secret sin, hidden to the outside world, but not hidden to God. And you wonder, how bad must their sin have been to deserve such a harsh penalty from the Lord? Now we might think the very idea is an insult to God. But before we're too hard on the disciples, you know, there are a lot of people that think in those lines today. We're tempted sometimes when we hear of a disaster, we hear of some horrible thing that happens, and we say, ooh, I wonder what they did to deserve that. I can remember when Hurricane Katrina came ashore to New Orleans, and how many preachers got up and preached, this is the judgment of God on those sinful people. Now, get over it. I take them right back to Luke 13, where Jesus pointed out some disasters that happened in his day, and he asked the question, were those people any more sinners than the ones who didn't suffer? And the answer was no. We need to stop trying to play detective and trying to find what sin caused this suffering. Now, we agree that all suffering ultimately comes from sin, but not always directly. Sometimes there is no direct line that we can reach. And honestly, it's not our job to do it. Let me just for a moment say that there is a situation where a person's sin directly led to a disability or some horrible thing that happened to them. Does that give us the right to pronounce judgment on them and their sin? No. Leave it to God. Don't be so concerned with who's to blame or trying to find the cause, unless you're Dr. House and you can save the person trying to, you know, by coming up with some unheard of cure. It's not going to do any good. Notice what Jesus says. His answer was short and to the point. You're both wrong. Neither this man sinned nor his parents. Just completely obliterated the whole debate. Took out both sides at once. But he goes on. This happened so that the work of God might be displayed in his life. Jesus is telling them and us, quit trying to find a cause, quit trying to assign blame. The whole process is futile because of our limited understanding. The book of Job ought to teach us that. But here Jesus says, this happened to this person so that God's purpose might be made manifest in his life. In other words, and if you don't get anything else out of this message than this, write this one down. Focus more on the purpose than the reason. When dealing with disabilities, focus more on the purpose than the reason. Because even if you can discover the reason, it won't help. But if you can discover the purpose, it can change a person's life. And what is God's purpose? Put very briefly, God's purpose is this: to display his glory by dispensing his grace. If you want to know what God is all about in the world, here it is: to display his glory by dispensing his grace. I'm not at all suggesting that God deliberately caused this child to be born blind so that after many years, Jesus could come along and remove it. It does mean that God overruled the disaster of the child's blindness so that when the child grew to manhood, he might, recovering his sight, see the glory of God in the face of Christ. And others, seeing this work of God, might turn to the true light of the world. That's the purpose that God works. See, in the final analysis, all physical problems are the result of our fallen Adam. His disobedience brought sin and death into the world. But beyond that, to blame a specific disability on a specific sin committed by a specific person is certainly beyond our authority or our ability. Only God knows the answers to those questions. Only God can turn those disabilities into something that will show his grace and manifest his glory. Donald Gray Barnhouse advises, we must ever realize that there are no pat answers for sickness and suffering in the world. Those who are trying to tell us that it is God's will for everyone to be healthy, then the only reason a person is not healthy is his lack of faith, that is sheer nonsense. To which I say a hearty amen. I have seen far too many suffering people, and too many of them have Job's counselors come and heap on a whole bunch of guilt because they say, well, if you had enough faith, you'd be healed. That's not the point at all, and that's not our place to judge. Speaking of sheer nonsense, the Pharisees enter the scene after Jesus had healed the blind man. Spoiler alert, in case you didn't know that was coming. Jesus heals the blind man. Afterwards, the Pharisees show up. And their attitude toward him, you could just be described as contemptible cynicism. To them, this man's only a tool. Not one time do you see the Pharisees or the Jewish leaders say, wow, that's great. Good for you. What a wonderful thing to happen in your life. All they care about is what day did this happen, who did it, and how did he do it? Because they had an agenda. And Jesus didn't fit their agenda. Jesus didn't fit into their little theological viewpoint on how the world should run. And they couldn't care less about that man, his blindness, or his healing. All they wanted to do was nail Jesus for doing something wrong. And when they found out that he had done this on the Sabbath, and that he had spit on the ground and made some clay and put it on the man's eyes, that's work. That's a sin. This is wrong. I don't know, that sounds to me a little bit like the echoes of that professor that I had in seminary. Contemptible cynicism. The blind man was reduced to a thing in order to accomplish a purpose. Now, in contrast to those attitudes, which people still take today, by the way, you see Jesus. And his attitude was one of compassionate concern. Notice verse 1 says, Jesus saw a man who was born blind. It doesn't say Jesus saw a beggar, though that's what he was doing. It didn't say that Jesus saw a blind man, though that's what he was. Jesus saw a man. See, what are you getting at? Let's get rid of the labels. Let's stop looking at people because of what we can observe about them or what they are doing, right or wrong, and understand that every person we encounter is a human being. A man, a woman, a boy, or a girl created in the image of God. That God cared so much for, he sent his son to die a horrible death on the cross to save that soul. And that applies to anybody you encounter. It doesn't matter how we can label them. And we're so good at labeling people today. We label people because of their ethnicity. We label people because of their addiction. We label people because of their cultural background or their education or lack thereof, whatever it might be, slap a label on them. How easy it is to judge someone else because they sin differently than I do. And that's not what we're called to do. Jesus saw a man who needed his help. And he felt that the man's condition called for action rather than discussion. Which leads us to the actions toward the disabled. Let's go back to the disciples. They avoided the obvious. They didn't do anything to help this man's predicament. Said, well, yeah, but they didn't have the power of Jesus. They couldn't heal him. Well, they could have helped him. They could have put some money in his cup. They could have gone by and said, "The Lord bless you." They didn't even do that. They avoided the obvious. They were like the priest and the Levite in the parable of the Good Samaritan. They went on the other side of the road and kept their distance. They were more interested in him as a point to be argued than a person to be assisted. Jumping ahead to the Pharisees again, they assailed the obstacle. When they found that he was not agreeable in their scheme against Jesus, they contemptuously cast him out and excommunicated him from the temple. He was no longer of use to them, so now he's a hindrance. And they attacked him. Jesus, though, took a different direction. He addressed the ordeal. Now, it's true, Jesus did something that only he could do. He cured the man. But I want you to notice, he took the initiative. Nobody asked. The blind man didn't say, "Oh, hey, Jesus, you want to help me out here?" Now, there were times when that did happen. Remember the 10 lepers? And they cried out to Jesus. But here, Jesus just took the initiative on his own. Nobody asked him to heal this man. He saw him. He gave him sight. And in doing so, he displayed the glory of God by dispensing the grace of God in the giving of sight. Now, God does the same thing today with regard to the disabled, though not always in the same manner. In this case, it happens to be healing. It's a miracle. The glory of God's power to heal. But it's not always in physical healing. We're told later that Paul cried out 3 times for the Lord to remove a thorn in the flesh. Now, we're not sure what that was. We're not even positive that it was physical, though many people feel that it was an eye issue. He may not have been completely blind, but he had some kind of eye ailment. Now, did he have enough faith? Come on, we're talking about the Apostle Paul here. Could God have healed him from whatever that physical malady was? Yes, but God didn't. 3 times God said no. He said, "My grace is sufficient for you." See, sometimes God works in a glorious way, miraculously healing, and other times he works by giving us the grace to get through it. And in both cases, God is equally at work. The healing is for his glory, the non-healing is for his glory, and grace is dispensed to both. See, suffering can only have meaning in relation to God. Only when we see it with regard to God being there and being in control of his world does it make any sense at all. Sometimes the Lord does heal physically. Sometimes he heals us spiritually. He heals a rebellious heart or an unforgiving spirit. Sometimes the change takes place in a moment. Other times it takes months, even years. But when it is finally complete, it sets us free. In the case of the blind beggar, we can see for all of us that have come to the cross and been healed spiritually, we all can see. We can all sing in the words of the hymn, "Once I was blind, but now I see." All to the glory of God and all by the grace of God. I'd like to conclude by seeing some applications regarding the disabled. And I want to first address the disabled among us. Maybe you've been agonizing yourself over the reason for your disability. You ask yourself, "Is God angry with me? Did I do something to deserve this? Why did this happen?" And the truth is, you'll probably never know the answers this side of heaven. And even if you did, it wouldn't make as much difference as you think it would. Focus instead on God's purpose for your condition. He wants to display his glory by dispensing his grace in your life. And that may come through healing. It may be medical, it may be miraculous. Or perhaps it'll come each day as he sustains and strengthens you, making you a shining example of what a Christian is all about. I think of Johnny Erickson Tada, who at the age of 17 dove into what she thought was deep water, and it wasn't. It broke her neck. She's a quadriplegic. She's been confined to a wheelchair for decades. And yes, she went through these same struggles. She wondered why. She had faith God would heal her. And she is still a quadriplegic in a wheelchair. But her life is a shining example of the grace of God. We can't pigeonhole God into always acting the same way to everybody. The promise that was given to Paul is true for you too. My grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. Second, for those who are not physically disabled, let's learn a lesson from the disciples on what not to do. Don't label them. Don't make them a matter of a theological or political or philosophical debate. Remember that first and foremost, you're dealing with a person. You're dealing with someone created by God and whom God loves. That makes them a person of worth. Know their name. Don't just refer to them as the blind person or the crippled person. Get to know their name. Get to know them. Many disabled folks suffer severe loneliness because others don't know what to do or to say around them. Just your time, your interest can be a great benefit. Find out what you can do to practically enhance their lives. We may not have the power to heal them, but we do have the power to help them. And you may find out, remember when the folks from the Christian home was here, talked about the lady that cancer had eaten away at her face and she had been alone for so many years. And yet when that preacher came to visit, she was the blessing. She gave the blessing. He thought he was going to come and bless her. She blessed him. You may find as you get to know these folks, you reach out a helping hand. They're going to bless you. You're going to be blessed, even as you bless their lives. And third, the healing of this blind man is presented as a parable of spiritual illumination. Even more profound than the man's physical inability to see was the spiritual blindness of those who are still trapped in sin. You get to the end of chapter 9, and Jesus tells those Pharisees, "You're blind. This guy can see, and you're still living in blindness. You live in darkness." What about us? Are we spiritually blind? Maybe we can understand spiritual blindness better through some common factors that affect our physical sight. Nearsightedness. A nearsighted person can't see things far away, and that's me. I can't even read this without my glasses. Spiritual nearsightedness occurs when a person is so wrapped up in their own situation, they can't see anything beyond their own circumstances. This is reflected in the words of Psalm 40, verse 12, "For troubles without number surround me, my sins have overtaken me, and I cannot see." Now, the prescription for spiritual nearsightedness is twofold. Lift your eyes and look to the heavens, we're told in Isaiah 40, 26. That redirects our focus on God. And then secondly, in the words of Jesus, "Do not say 4 months more to the harvest. I tell you, open your eyes and look at the fields. They are ripe for harvest." See, that takes the focus off of ourselves and onto others. Nearsightedness is always looking within. Look to God, look to others. Now, how about farsightedness? A farsighted person can't see things up close. They can see everybody else's problems, but they're blind to their own. To such, Jesus says, "Why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye and pay no attention to the plank in yours? How can you say to your brother, 'Let me take that speck out of your eye,' when all the time there's a plank sticking out of your eye? You hypocrite, take the plank out of your eye first, and then you can see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eyes." Cataracts. A number of you have suffered from cataracts. Some have had surgery for them. They're cloudy lenses that block vision. It's a leading cause of blindness today. Spiritual cataracts are represented in Isaiah 6, verses 9 and 10. Go and tell these people, be ever hearing but never understanding, be ever seeing but never perceiving. Make the heart of this person, the people, calloused, make their ears dull and close their eyes. Otherwise, they might see with their eyes and hear with their ears, understand with their hearts, and turn and be healed. Notice the calloused condition mentioned here. Cataracts are like calluses of the eyes, hard, deadened skin that is no longer sensitive or receptive. Spiritual cataracts develop as we continue to resist the Holy Spirit's counsel and conviction. Eventually, we're just not sensitive anymore. We're spiritually blind and we don't even know it. There's night blindness. Some folks just can't see at night. They find themselves in a dark situation. All they can see is darkness. Jesus said in Matthew 6, 22 and 23, the eye is the lamp of the body. If your eyes are good, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eyes are bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. If then the light within you is darkness, how great is that darkness? Spiritual night blindness keeps us from seeing the true light within our dark world. And it tempts many Christians to give up, to conclude that there's no hope for themselves or for their world. To such, Paul writes in 2 Corinthians 4, 16 through 18, therefore we do not lose heart, though outwardly we are wasting away, yet inwardly we are being renewed day by day. For our light and momentary troubles are achieving for us an eternal glory that far outweighs them all. Now here's his prescription. So we fix our eyes not on what is seen, but on what is unseen. For what is seen is temporary, what is unseen is eternal. This leads me to my final correlation between physical and spiritual sight, and that's the condition of being cross-eyed. Some people are born cross-eyed. Some with normal vision can sometimes cross their eyes. I remember a photograph many years ago. Both my brothers and I, we were gathered around a microphone on a stand, and we decided we were going to take a picture like we're in a recording studio. And my brother Bob on this side, he kind of cupped his hand to his ear, and my brother Ed on the other side. And I'm looking straight into the microphone, and if you look at the picture, it looks like my eyes are crossed. Because I don't know why I was looking at the mic, but I was. Now, unlike the other analogies of physical vision ailments with spiritual counterparts, I would suggest that spiritual cross-eyedness, I don't think that's the right word, but whatever, being spiritually cross-eyed is a good thing. Consider Hebrews 12:2. Let us fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy before him endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. See, when we concentrate our spiritual vision on our Savior and on his cross, we'll gain a perspective like we've never had before. Now, I know this is a kind of a heavy message. It covers a broad spectrum, everything from physical disability to spiritual blindness, how we respond to various people. Just remember, God has a purpose for your life and for the life of anybody you encounter. And that is to display his glory by dispensing his grace. And he'd like to use us in doing that. For those of you that are suffering from a disability, focus more on the purpose than on the reason. Stop asking why and start asking, how, God, can you use me? For those of us who are enjoying good health, when we encounter those who suffer, who are disabled, resist the temptation to label. Don't try to figure out why they're the way they are. Leave that to God. What you're called to do is to love them. Maybe you can't heal them, but you can help them. And we all need to take a spiritual eye exam and make sure that we're not suffering from spiritual blindness, but that we come to the light of the world, who is Jesus. I'd like you to take your hymnals as we close. Turn to hymn number 278. Open my eyes that I may see. This is a hymn we can all sing as our prayer this morning. Will you stand with me? We'll just sing the first verse, hymn number 278.